That's a wrap. Parliament rose on Friday for the summer break with no expectation to return until after the election. Even though the election is months away, the campaign is well underway.
Rallying the troops. The fight for center-left is on.
And our plan is the best way to bring real change.
Are you ready for change?
This place is broken. Together, we're going to fix it.
Are you ready to replace Stephen Harper's Conservatives with an NDP government and get Canada on track?
Do the Conservatives stand to benefit from this battle? And with the NDP riding high in the polls, can Justin Trudeau's plan for the middle class restore the Liberal Party to its former glory?
Joining me now from Toronto is Liberal leader Justin Trudeau. Mr. Trudeau, the campaign is clearly underway. And, you know, starting out, you were riding high in the polls just a few months ago. But the NDP has surged, moving ahead of you in most polls. What happened?
I think it's normal that polls go up and down. The one thing that really matters to me is how we're engaging with Canadians and presenting a plan for real change. And the response that we're getting across the country as people understand how committed we are to being a strong, clear alternative to Mr. Harper's style of governing and the policies that are not giving us the kind of growth and opportunity that Canadians need. This is what the campaign is all about, and I'm excited that people are starting to pay attention.
Well, part of that policy is this book, the 32-point plan, but buried within, I mean, there's at least 70 promises, I'm sure. A number of them look a lot like promises already made by the NDP. Are you worried you're looking a little too much like that party?
On the contrary, one of the things that we've seen over the past 10 years, Mr. Harper has broken Ottawa. And we need to make sure that people understand that we're planning to fix it. And the Liberal Party has always been a party that looks at pragmatic solutions ways of fulfilling the values that Canadians want to see from their governance.
But even when you talk about Ottawa is broken, it needs to be fixed, you're the party to fix it, that is an NDPism. That goes back to the late Jack Layton. He used to say that a lot. Does that not sound too much like the NDP?
Focused on is listening to Canadians who are telling me about the frustration they're seeing after having a government for 10 years that hasn't been responding to their concerns. And there's been lots of ideas put forward by different political parties, by experts, about how to fix Parliament. And what we've done is we've put forward a concrete plan for real change. And I'm actually very, very proud of the collection of sweeping proposals that will make Ottawa function much better and remember that it is there to serve Canadians, not serve whatever party's in power like we've had for too long.
In your speech, when you did deliver this 32-point plan, you attacked Prime Minister Stephen Harper more than a dozen times and never once mentioned NDP leader Tom Mulcair or even the NDP. Are you going to have to start pushing against him and against the left given the NDP surge right now?
Well, Laura, you've heard me a number of times when asked about attacks from other parties say, look, I'm going to stay focused on Canadians. I'll let the other parties focus on me.
But you did focus on Mr. Harper, though. You have to admit in that. You did come after Mr. Harper harder than you normally would. I'll give you that. You normally don't do it. But at least a dozen times you went after Mr. Harper
I did because we're talking about the fact that our democracy, that our parliament, that our government has not been behaving in a way that actually restores confidence for Canadians, or that gives the kind of solutions and fairness that Canadian families need. And that is something that is directly Mr. Harper's responsibility. So I can't talk about the changes we need to make to government without talking about why those changes are necessary. And that's what we're going to continue to do, to put forward a strong and clear contrast to what's gone on before, but also putting forward responsible and real ideas to bring that change about. And that's That's at the heart of this plan, whether it's openness and transparency, access to information for ministers and parliamentary and prime minister's office, whether it's reforming our electoral system. These are all concrete ideas and concrete plans to make that real change happen.
One of the things on electoral reform and democracy, you know, that is, it's a pretty heady issue, and you're not the first to tackle it. In fact, your predecessor, Michael Ignatieff, tried that, and we all know how that worked out. It's not exactly popular with voters. Are you really going to go out there and campaign on this issue, or did you just drop it to get it in so that people know you believe in it?
Oh, I think the mood out there across the country is quite unmistakable. The fact that people have now seen what Mr. Harper is like with a majority government, that we've seen what 10 years of Stephen Harper as Prime Minister bring, people are extremely open and excited about real change that's going to make a difference in how governments are chosen and how governments function. And that's something that I'm getting great feedback from right across the country already.
But they don't seem to. I understand it is an important issue. There's no question about that. And many people are concerned about it. But do they vote about? Do they vote on this issue? They didn't the last time.
But,
what makes you think they're going to vote on this issue?
What Canadians understand very clearly is that actually changing the way we elect governments and changing how governments behave leads to a much better quality of decision making, a more collaboration with the provinces and municipalities, a better understanding of the positions and the arguments made by opposition parties, a respect for scientists and for evidence-based policy. This kind of plan, which is about the style and substance of governing, actually leads to better policies and better solutions. And that's what Canadians want. They want to see a government that is focused on serving them, of offering fairness and growth that helps everyone. That's the kinds of things that people want, and that's what we're going to be able to deliver once we restore a semblance of openness and democracy to the way our leadership functions in Ottawa.
Well, one policy, or at least legislation now, and a law, is Bill C-51. You supported that. You've been roundly criticized by it. You're now down in the polls. Tom Mulcair voted against it. He's up. Did you make a strategic mistake in supporting Bill C-51?
I think it's we've all seen what polls do, and linking things too directly is always a bit of a mug's game. But the fact is that yes, Canadians have real concerns because they've seen a government that hasn't done a very good job of protecting physical security while upholding the rights and freedoms that we cherish as a country. And that's why the Liberal Party made a responsible decision to say, we are going to support the matters, that the elements that protect Canadians' actual security in their communities, in their homes, in our streets, but at the same time commit to repealing and repairing the egregious challenges with C-51. And that is a position that is not playing into the politics of fear that we're getting from both sides.
But it doesn't Mr. Trudeau, it doesn't seem to be playing with your voters, though. I mean, it's even the optics. I understand you'll repeal parts of it. You don't agree with all of it. But your base, young voters, are really unhappy with this.
You know, I've been out there across the country listening to Canadians, talking with Canadians with concerns about this, and I get those concerns and I agree with those concerns. But we have an awful long way to go still till the election, and we're going to continue to refuse to play the politics of fear or division, whether it's playing up fear of terrorists or fear for environmentalists or community groups or Aboriginal groups or even Muslim Canadians. This is the politics that I have stepped forward to reject, that kind of divisive attacks. We don't want to play politics around national security, and we will continue to take responsible positions and not pander to the kinds of attacks that, quite frankly, grow cynicism that lessens a government's ability to address the issues in a way that Canadians want us to.
Okay, thanks. Good luck.
Always a pleasure, Laurie.
All right. Joining us now, MPs who are done over there, but they will be out on the barbecue circuit any day now. Here in the studio, opposition House Leader Peter Julian and Conservative Scott Armstrong. Hello, gentlemen. And from Moncton, Liberal House Leader Dominic LeBlanc. So we'll start with you, Scott Armstrong. So you've lost another Conservative colleague. James Moore has announced that he is not returning to politics. He's not the first. Shelley Glover is gone. James Rajad is gone. Peter McKay is gone. A lot of them are from the front bench. What are you? Are they running scared? What do they know something we don't know?
Well. Look, these are long-serving members of Parliament. In James's case, he has a young family, and there are some medical issues. And as Peter knows, traveling back and forth to Ottawa on a weekly basis from all the way out in BC is a tough task. And so I wish James the best. He's been a terrific member of the Parliament. He's been a great cabinet minister. I've enjoyed working with him, and quite frankly, I look forward to seeing him in the future. But I wish him well.
Yeah, but Mr. Julian, some would say that the Conservatives are running scared. You guys are leading in the polls. What do you think?
Well, I wish James Moore well, and I wish him all the best for him and his family. But it is very true. When you look at the Conservative front bench, it's been decimated. There are very few front benchers even running again. And so I think that's an indication. Some have different reasons from others, and obviously there's some turnover between any four-year period. But I think it would be worrisome for anybody who believes that the Conservative government should be reelected to see that all of their front benchers have decided not to run again. And I think that's something that Mr. Harper is going to have to respond to in the months leading up to the next election.
And the Conservatives have already come out and ad against your leader, Mr. Mulcair, for not knowing the corporate tax rate in an interview he did. It is a very clear attack against you. Do you think that, if they're coming after you now, what is that telling you? Should he have known the corporate tax rate, I guess, is one of the questions.
Well, he was talking about the corporate tax differential between the United States and Canada. But we know that the Conservatives are going to come after us. They've already indicated that. I think the response that Tom Mulcair got from the business community in Toronto this week and in Montreal last week shows that he has a lot of credibility on economic policies. When you get standing ovations from business leaders in those two cities, I think that's a strong indication that the NDP is putting forward economic policies that the public and even the business community is saying would be good news for Canada.
Dominic LeBlanc, I mean, your party, I talked to your leader and I asked him, a number of questions. Not once did he mention the name Tom Mulcair. And in his policy, he mentioned Stephen Harper a dozen times, but not once did he mention Tom Mulcair, even in dropping policy. Why are you guys not going after the NDP? Why not go after Tom Mulcair? He's the target right now, no?
Well, look, our target always has been Mr. Harper and his bad policies and what they've done for Canadians and the damage that they've inflicted on middle-class Canadian families, the economic record of the government, the ethical scandals that have engulfed the government. That's what we have been prosecuting in Parliament and our leader has been articulating across the country.
Well, you could put a piece of paper between the policies of the NDP and the policies of the Liberal. Both revolve around raising taxes. We're focused on managing the economy, lowering taxes for all Canadians, specifically seniors and Canadians with children, and we're going to make sure we keep Canadians safe.
And, Laurie, that's the two really Achilles heels of the Conservative Party. First off, when you look at the economy, 400,000 lost manufacturing jobs and a record debt level for Canadian families. I mean, these last 10 years have been very tough times for Canadian families. So for the Conservatives, the campaign on the economy is going to be a weak point for them. And on security, C-51, which started off having a certain level of support as Canadian Bar Association, as former Supreme Court justices, as everybody weighed in. We saw the shift in the polls that you talked about, and we also saw most Canadians saying this idea to try to use security to re-elect the Conservative government is something that most Canadians reject. And that's why you've seen such a strong reaction for the Conservatives and Liberals voting for C-51 when Tom Mulcair was the only leader to stand up and say, no, C-51 is not in Canadians' interest. We shouldn't be sacrificing rights and liberties for this package that the Conservative Party put forward.
Every time the NDP come up with some sort of argument to stop the security of Canadians, C-51 only gives our police the powers that most other countries in the industrialized world already have. The problem is the NDP put rights above security. We believe that you can have rights and security both at the same time. In terms of the economy, we have the best debt to GDP ratio of any country in the G7. We have a balanced budget like we promised in the 2011 campaign, and we're doing this while lowering taxes for all Canadians.
Dominic LeBlanc, I can hear you laughing back there.
Yeah, Scott is doing a great job. He's regurgitating the Prime Minister's office talking points, and that's good. The idea that they have a balanced budget, Laurie, Canadians know that that is largely a fiction. They sold off a bunch of assets. They cut taxes for a bunch of rich people. They've avoided spending billions of dollars on. They've avoided spending billions of dollars to help veterans, to help seniors. To invest in infrastructure, to create jobs now that are needed and unlock some of the gridlock and some of the environmental damage that crumbling infrastructure is causing. So they've created a fictitious surplus at all costs by, frankly, in our view, being irresponsible in a number of investments. They talk about security. Canadians don't trust Mr. Harper with their rights.
But you supported C-51, too. You supported C-51, too, so it's a little hard for you to criticize the government on C-51, no?
No, I think we've been quite clear what we would have done differently. We believe that there were a number of elements in that legislation that should have been enacted quickly. We think the government failed completely, for example, on the oversight, civilian oversight that was demanded by a number of experts and the Canadians expect. Canadians think that we can have robust and effective security measures, and some of them were contained in that legislation, but they also don't trust Mr. Harper with that security apparatus, and that's why we've committed very quickly Liberal government, there are a number of measures that will improve the oversight.
We believe in security and protecting the rights of Canadians. The Liberals are trying to be keep you a half here by saying we support it, but we don't really support it. We only support it when it's good for us. When it's up in the polls, down in the polls, we don't support it.
Laurie, the reality is this government has no credibility. When you look at the opinion polls time after time after time, the Conservatives sometimes second place, sometimes third place. There is a very low level of confidence in Mr. Harper in terms of any Canadian political leader in the country. His approval ratings are dismally low.
You are riding high right now in the polls, there's no question. And we know provinces are ready for an NDP government. We saw it in Alberta. What makes you think that nationally Canadians are ready for an NDP government?
Well, we have to do a lot of work this summer, there's no doubt. But when we see Tom Mulcair going before a business community in places like Toronto and Montreal getting standing ovations, when we see the rallies that we've seen across the country in places like Surrey, BC and Saskatoon, standing room only crowds, 1,000 people, 1,500 people out, those are all indications that Tom Mulcair has struck a chord with the Canadian population. But we know there's months to go, and we're going to keep on working hard. I get off the plane this weekend, and what I do is I go door to door. And so that's what we will all be doing, I think, over the course of the next few months.
And do you think they can sustain it, Mr. Armstrong?
Well, look, we've seen this before with the NDP. They've lost 16 consecutive federal elections in Canada. This one will be no different. Canadians know they can trust the Prime Minister to focus on what Canadians are truly focused on, their future, the economy, and their security. That's the priority.
Last word from Moncton.
Look, Laurie, it's obviously a very, very fluid circumstance. The polls have been moving around over the last number of years, a year and a half, last number of months. I believe fundamentally the Canadians want to change the government. They want to get rid of Mr. Harper's tired and out-of-touch government. They want to replace it with a better government. And I'm very confident when they see what Justin Trudeau is offering Canadians and the Liberal platform, they will turn to the Liberal Party to replace a tired and out-of-touch government.
All right, we'll see.
Watch your wallet. High taxes are coming.
Very interesting summer on the barbecue circuit, I'm sure. So have a great summer. Good luck campaigning, everyone.
Thanks, Laurie.
Thanks, Laurie.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Peter. Thanks, Scott.
Still to come, allegations of sexual misconduct on Parliament Hill.
I'm disgusted by what he's done.
A former top-ranking Senate insider on the latest scandal. But first, will an outgoing minister run for the leadership of the Conservative Party? Peter McKay joins me next on Question Period. Welcome back. Over 50 MPs are giving up their seats and not running in the next election. And the latest, Industry Minister James Moore.
There comes a point where after 15 years in politics, five terms, that you realize you have to make sure your priorities are right. And I'm just tired of leaving my son at the airport crying and coming to Ottawa, and 15 years has been an amazing experience. And I'm still an MP up until the campaign, and I'm going to be campaigning for Stephen Harper all the way through.
Moore is part of a long list of Conservatives bailing from Stephen Harper's front bench. Veteran Tory MP Peter McKay has also called it quits.
Congratulations to Peter McKay for having division.
McKay started as a progressive conservative, eventually became the leader, but his deal with Stephen Harper united the right and ushered in years of conservative rule.
Peter McKay and I are pleased to announce that we have officially created the new Conservative Party of Canada.
I, Peter Gordon McKay, do solemnly...
The six-time MP for Central Nova built an impressive cabinet CV, Minister of Foreign Affairs, Defense, and Justice.
So help me God. I love what I do. And I love the opportunities that it afforded me to help others, but simply put, I love my family more.
In May, McKay's surprise decision to exit federal politics had the two main architects of the party shaking hands again.
Joining me now is Peter McKay from beautiful Halifax. Good morning, Minister. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too, Laurie. Nice to be home.
I'm sure it is. Before we start, I want to talk to you about Senator Don Meredith. I know that this is a very difficult topic and the allegations of a two-year relationship with a teenager. You're a family man. I'm just wondering, what was your reaction when you first heard this?
Well, chilling, deeply disturbing, given the age here and the circumstance. The issue around trust, of course, is immediately part of the calculation, but given that this is still an allegation and due process as Minister of Justice, Attorney General, I have to be respectful of that. But certainly at a personal level, it's very troubling, deeply disturbing.
He has been removed from the Conservative caucus, but is there a mechanism to suspend him from the Senate until this whole thing is dealt with?
Well, we've seen this before. In fact, there's precedent for it where investigations or even criminal investigations are underway. But that is really a question for the leadership within the Senate. And so I would direct you to ask that question of the Senate itself.
Okay, let's get back to you and this 18-year career of yours. It's got to be hard to sum up all of these years. But when you look back, what will stand out for you?
Well, first and foremost, the trust that I have garnered from my constituency back in Central Nova. No member of Parliament achieves anything without that support. And over time, six elections, 18 years, as you said, that's what I'm most proud of, is that I maintained that connection. I hope that I delivered for them locally, whether it was infrastructure, whether it was accessibility, being in three offices on a regular basis and hearing directly from constituents, attending events around a beautiful, beautiful part of Nova Scotia that you're familiar with. Perhaps the single greatest joy that I would reflect on over those 18 years, 6 years at the Department of National Defense, and seeing our best citizens at work in their environment, either at home or abroad, really breathtaking, and I have nothing but admiration, and I found such inspiration in the work that they did.
You know, when you were defense minister, you certainly wore that role well. And as you say, it was a highlight for you. I'm wondering, how difficult was it for you to hear the news of sexual harassment, sexual assault, all that was going on?
It really does trouble me to my core that this appeared to be happening in a broad way across the Canadian forces. Now they have the Ducharme report, which makes specific recommendations, which they have embraced and will be in the process of adapting. However, it will take attitude changes. It will take a much more concentrated effort in the future to hold those accountable who would be ever so inclined. I know that there is updated military justice now. I was a part of some of that change. And we have now a victims bill that will also enhance the protection necessary, not only in the military, but across society. So the justice system is evolving, changing, doing more to protect individuals in the workplace. And I think that there are strong lessons and further education and work that has to happen.
You know, you are a progressive conservative. You talk a lot about your constituents. I mean, you come from progressive conservative country. That's the territory. You're one of the few left in Stephen Harper's cabinet. And as justice minister, I'm wondering, how difficult Was it or has it been for you to be, as a progressive conservative, bringing down laws that many progressive conservatives would say are hard line? They are really more extreme than what we might normally do in Canada. Mandatory minimums being an example.
Not at all, and I would disagree with that calculation, Laurie, insofar as protecting people also means holding people accountable. And the victims bill I've spoke of, but also mandatory minimum penalties send a strong message of deterrence and denunciation for victimization, particularly acts of violence and sexual violence. And so I'm completely comfortable, as should progressive people be with our justice system, when we are protecting especially children, especially those who are vulnerable, especially individuals who need to know that the system is going to protect them and then include them and embrace them. I'm comfortable across the spectrum of the things that we've done as a government. I'm comfortable with the people who I view many of them as coming from what they might call different wings or origins of the conservative movement. But let's not forget, as I said earlier, this is a party that traces its roots, its ancestry to the very beginnings of Canada, and it was known as the Conservative Party. We have simply reunified conservatives, as we've done in the past, and that involves having that larger body of Canadians who come from different regions, different backgrounds, different perspectives, and we are a very strong united party and a force, and the government today. And I'm not disappearing, I'm not running again, but I am certainly going to be involved.
You're not disappearing?
Locally and nationally.
Well, sorry,
I'm not running this time, but I am. I'm going to be involved in my party. I'm going to be involved in what I consider to be my conservative family.
You're not running this time, but might you be running in the future?
Lori, my immediate future is to spend more time with my family. I obviously will continue to work because I need to support my family, myself, but I'm stepping back from politics to allow myself to do that and to have greater experience in the private sector.
Let me ask you this, though. Not every Canadian has an opportunity. Not every Canadian, most Canadians, can never say, I have a chance to be the Prime Minister of Canada. You can say that, given all that you've done, that you are a member of the Conservative Party. You could leave and come back. Getting ahead of this and looking back, if you're somebody in this country who could actually say you have an opportunity to be the Prime Minister, if you don't go for it, won't you regret that?
I think it's important not to have regrets. It's important to make informed decisions. It's something we all reflect on in our personal lives. My priority is my family. That takes precedence over anything else. I obviously will continue to work. I'm not 50 yet, so I have another career ahead of me, I hope. And so the priority, as I said, is really here. It's local. It's where my home and my heart and my family will be. And I want to spend more time with loved ones.
But you're not closing the door. You haven't said no.
Look, I think it would be naive to simply say that you would never do something. And Jean Charest, another leader that I worked with, I recall when he left federal politics and, saying never say never. My father's sage advice about don't lock a door unless you have to. But that is not on my radar, to be frank. My focus is the family. That was the driving reason for this departure and stepping back from politics. But I've loved my experience in politics. I've met so many wonderful people. I've seen the world. I've had experiences I would never have dreamed of growing up in Lorne and going to a one-room schoolhouse. It has been an absolutely astonishing experience over the last 18 years. And the best part of it was the people that I met, particularly those who serve our country so valiantly in uniform, and many from different parts of the world who gave me a perspective on what a great country we have and how grateful we should be every day for what we call Canada.
Well, Minister, good luck to you. And I am not convinced that this is the last time that I will talk to you as a politician, but it might be for a while. So good luck and thanks for this.
Well, I hope we'll meet again soon, Lori, when we're both not online.
And coming up, more on those allegations of an inappropriate sexual relationship between a senator and a teenager. How can the upper chamber deal with this most recent scandal? That's next on Question Period.
disgusted. I'm disgusted by what he's done.
Now, this is just awful. It's sickening. He should do the right thing and resign from the Senate.
Senators reacting to the news that their colleague Don Meredith has been accused of sexual misconduct and harassment. He was booted out of the Conservative caucus on Wednesday, but still remains as a sitting senator. For more on this, we're joined by former Senate clerk Gordon Barnhart. Mr. Barnhart, Mr. Meredith may not be in Conservative caucus, but he is still a senator. What are the rules around suspending him from the Senate until this whole situation is dealt with?
Well, this has been a relatively new experience in terms of suspending senators. And as you know, we have several senators that have already been suspended. So that would be a decision, basically, first off, of the party to remove him from the now sitting as a Conservative senator. To remove him actually from the Senate itself would require a resolution of the Senate.
So I guess, you know, when you look at this, all of these senators trying to make a decision about that, many of them we talked with yesterday, a lot saying, you know, he shouldn't be there. They were disgusted, found just the whole situation deplorable. Has it ever happened before that senators would get together and decide that even though it's still before the courts or there's still some question about whether it's going to be before the courts, you know, has there ever been a situation where the senators got together and said, that's it, you're out altogether?
Well, you know, in many cases like this, it's usual to wait until there's some resolution of a court case with charges rather than not waiting for a decision. But there were two examples that I can think of. Senator Burnson was accused of wrongdoing in Saskatchewan and resigned before there was final resolution. I believe, in fact, there were criminal charges in that case. He resigned. The other one that I can think of is Senator Thompson, the senator who spent more of his time in Mexico than he did in the Senate. And after quite a controversy, he also resigned.
So short of the senators getting together to make a decision about Mr. Meredith, are there any other penalties that can be imposed?
Well, I guess ostracization in terms of if he's not part of any of the political parties, he would be still sitting as a senator. We're going into a summer break as well, as you would be aware. And so perhaps the pressure will be off until the fall at least, and then we're into an election. So the Senate doesn't disappear during an election, but obviously they wouldn't be sitting either. So the pressure having him in the chamber during this with a cloud over his head wouldn't be quite as apparent, I don't think, because we're heading into that summer recess.
Now, he's not the only one in that chamber with a cloud over his head. There are 30 senators. Now, these are for spending issues. They're before the RCMP. 9 are indeed being investigated, but the other 21 are being reviewed by the RCMP. And at the same time, there's this arbitration process that is supposed to happen. How will that work?
Well, I'm not quite sure. The Auditor General has made recommendations, and those are recommendations. Throughout my whole life in public service, I've always valued the recommendations of an Auditor General. They're professionals, and they are neutral, and they're giving the best advice possible. They'll be up to the Senate to, if they're going to garnish wages or stop payments to senators, to collect the money back if the senators don't pay it back voluntarily. So it's not as if there's going to be a penalty as of today if a deadline isn't met by the Auditor General, but it would be the Senate to make that decision.
All right. And then just finally, I mean, you were the clerk, the upper chamber, the high house. This was it. I mean, did you ever imagine that you would see the Senate fall into the swamp like this?
Well, you know, there were some issues when I started back in 89 to 94. And in fact, we had an Auditor General's report way back then. Ken Dye was the Auditor General. He made a major report with many different recommendations. I was able to implement about 3/4 of them that pertained to the administration. And thankfully, we got that done. 25% of it, though, was up to the senators to make changes on how their expenses were claimed. They chose at that time not to make those changes, and perhaps they regret that now. I certainly wish they had made the changes then. I make the argument that we wouldn't be in the situation we are today.
And it is quite a situation. Thanks so much for your input today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we'll be chatting about the Senate more with our journalists in the Scrum. That's coming up next on Question Period. We'll be right back. And welcome back. It's time for The Scrum. Joining me, my colleagues and friends, Gloria Galloway from the Globe and Mail, John Iveson from the National Post, Tonda McCharles from the Toronto Star, and my colleague and friend, Craig Oliver. So, everybody, another one bites the dust. James Moore announced that he's stepping down. A long list of MPs leaving, but also a number from Stephen Harper's front bench. Craig, what does this tell you?
Well, I can count six ministers of various profiles, if you include Jim Flaherty, who are all look like they're jumping ship. What do they know that we don't know? And this certainly does leave an impression of a government that is having its problems, that doesn't look like it's really ready for the kind of fight it's going to be in when this campaign begins. And I think that must be very worrisome for Mr. Harper, who looks like he's out there all alone, running really a one-man government and a one-man campaign.
Big loss for them also in BC, in the sense that James has been the political minister for BC, where there's a huge battle on for the seats there, and between the NDP and the Conservatives in many ridings. So, the loss of James Moore is a blow to the government, just as McKay and others were. I don't necessarily see it as, you know, some people might suggest it, he'll look much less moderate as a result. These are all ministers who went along with Stephen Harper's policies for so many years.
But that's what I think.
But this is different.
There's a very specific reason here as well. It's the health of his son. And I have no doubts that that is the motivating force here.
Some of them are without a doubt personal. Some of them, Shelley Glover was leaving for personal reasons as well. But
she's going to be a cop in North Winnipeg when she goes back.
But it does feel like they are bailing.
Well, it is not only the health of the son. He also has very young children as well. And you can see going back and forth across the globe, the country all the time, that it'd be very difficult on a young family to do that. But I absolutely think it's a very big blow for that party, especially in British Columbia. Not only is he an important force in British Columbia, but British Columbia, they need to win every single seat they've got.
That's right.
British Columbia, I could see this election being won or lost in British Columbia, the way things are shaping up. And they're seats are touch and go out there, and it'd be very, very difficult, I think, to find somebody of his stature in that province right now that's conservative.
It really doesn't matter why any of them leave. The fact is, these are important regional ministers, Paradis, for instance, in Quebec, who can bring votes in, who can attract attention, who can make news. And he's lost all of these, and he doesn't seem to have Jason Kenney, maybe, Lisa Raitt. He doesn't have a lot of replacements ready to go.
And I would say that, you know, it's interesting that a lot of them have discovered their family reasons for leaving in June.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
You might want to have given the PM a heads up a lot earlier.
It is curious, too, that some of them, Peter McKay being the example, that there's always the question about, is he coming back? Will he run one day for the leadership? Mm-hmm. I mean, is this also a sign that some of these MPs are leaving so that if they do eventually decide they want to run, they want to leave as somebody who resigned as opposed to somebody who lost?
That certainly applies to Peter McKay, no question. Moore, I'm not sure.
Well, Moore won by 13,000 votes last time. I don't think he would have lost.
He could be with a losing party. We don't know that.
I think a lot of the Conservatives I was talking to are not particularly rattled, partly because the rise of the NDP is very good news for them in and around Toronto. And, they're a lot of them are quietly confident that, despite